You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. A ship carrying food supplies for Gaza is waiting off the coast in a test run of what it's hoped will become a new route for aid into the territory. The Spanish-flagged boat has sailed from Cyprus. More from Anna Foster in Jerusalem.
The ship is moving closer. It will face challenges when it does actually arrive at the coastline of Gaza. They've been building a temporary jetty to actually unload some of that aid. So that will be the first problem, because this will be untried and untested. It'll be a difficult and delicate operation. And also, once the aid is actually off the barge, they'll need to find a way to distribute it safely and securely, actually, to the population in Gaza who need it. And the aid situation there, as we've said repeatedly, is desperate at the moment.
Russia is holding a presidential election with Vladimir Putin the only serious candidate and certain to win. The three-day vote is being held a month after the death of the main Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny in an Arctic prison, with the Kremlin widely seen as responsible. Russian investigators have arrested a woman who appeared to pour a dark liquid into a ballot box after casting her vote near Moscow. Officials in the Ukrainian city of Odessa say at least 14 people have been killed in Russian missile attacks on a residential area. The governor of the Black Sea port said a medic and a rescue worker were among the dead. He said a further 46 people were wounded. More details from Sarah Rainsford in Kyiv.
There was a missile attack. The Ukrainian authorities are saying it was a residential area of Odessa. Several houses were hit. They say there was a gas pipe which was also on fire for a time. And they say it was when the rescue workers went to the scene to try to see if there was anyone under the rubble, to give first aid at the scene and to rescue people, there was then a second Russian rocket fired. And that was when two rescue workers were killed.
The government in the Democratic Republic of Congo says it's decided to resume carrying out executions as a result of the armed conflicts in the east of the country and what it called urban banditry. A moratorium on the death penalty was introduced more than two decades ago. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reports.
Congo's Justice Ministry in Kinshasa said the moratorium on carrying out the death penalty had fueled impunity. The decision to resume executions appears to be mainly driven by events in the mineral-rich east of the country. There, for the last three decades, civilians have suffered relentless abuses due to attacks by dozens of rebel groups. Neighbouring countries, including Rwanda and Uganda, have also at times fueled the conflict. Soldiers in the Congolese army could now be executed if they're found guilty of treason or failing to carry out orders to attack the enemy. The military has frequently been accused of gross indiscipline and corruption involving the mineral wealth.
Will Ross reporting. This is the latest world news from the BBC.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
The Barrymore Theatre presents Dan Savage's Hump 2024 Film Festival on Saturday, March 16th. Hump is a curated festival of short erotic films made by real people for real people. The filmmakers and stars show us a cornucopia of body types, shapes, ages, colors, sexualities, genders, kinks, and fetishes, all united by a shared spirit of sex positivity. The Hump Film Festival is now in its 19th year of redefining how we see erotic things on the screen. And it's coming to the Barrymore Theatre on Saturday, March 16th at 7:30 p.m. bringing you entertainment for the mind and the body for over 45 years. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org.
Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. It's March 15. I'm Andy Moore. First up, this station announcement. You might want to jot this down. The Winter Pledge Drive has been extended. The Winter Pledge Drive will run until May 15. The Spring Pledge Drive will commence on May 16 and run until June 9. The Summer Pledge Drive begins on June 11th, 36 hours after the Spring Pledge Drive concludes. I'm kidding. Of course I'm kidding. The Summer Pledge Drive doesn't actually begin until June 12th. No one would schedule them that close together. Come on. I'm kidding. It just feels so good to get through 2 weeks of fundraising in one piece. And thank you guys. Because we made it, all in one piece. We made our goal both weeks and then some. Thank you very much. Okay, sports news this week. Well, kind of sports news and kind of the future of our country news. Aaron Rodgers acknowledged Robert F. Kennedy's possible selection of him as his vice president running mate. If I sound a little bit nervous, because we only have, we have like 5 minutes with him now. And this came together late last night, very last minute through the RFK campaign. But Aaron Rodgers joins us now by phone from Santa Clara, California. Do we have him, Jim Wilson? Aaron Rodgers, it's early on the West Coast.
Yeah, we have him. It seems like he just didn't really have anything else to do this morning. So.
Okay. All right. It's early out there. And that was a cheap shot, Jim. Mr. Aaron Rodgers, are you there?
Yeah. Hello.
Hey, this is a big deal. Football is a big deal. But this is something else altogether. What is it that you and RFK Jr. share in your vision for the future of America?
Yeah, we share a lot. He believes in the importance of a strong passing game, which, clearly I bring to the table. And I think it's
passing game
important to remember a lot of presidents and presidential candidates have played the game. You know, we're talking about Gerald Ford.
That's true.
About Jack Kemp. We're talking about Ronald Reagan.
I hadn't thought about that.
You know,
yeah.
Ronald Reagan wore the old leather type helmet.
That's true.
And I think there have been some improvements in the game, so
I think
we've got harder helmets now.
All of that lines up. You've made a lot of calls on the playing field, last second, everything on the line, decisions that led to many thrilling victories. But the vice presidency, Aaron, as they say, you know, one heartbeat from being commander in chief of the United States. What specifically, we've laid down your passing game, what specifically do you bring to that job?
Well, I think if you look at that passing game, I think, you know, you see a lot of smart decisions. And, you know, there's been talk I could be a coach. I don't think that's loose talk. I think it's serious conversations. I think how effective have I been in healing a serious injury? You know, right now, doing some toe raises for about 2 days. I'm back on the field after a serious, Achilles injury. So I think you bring that kind of, efficiency to the presidency. I think that makes me a serious candidate, Andy.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking very briefly with Aaron Rodgers, who you may have read this week has been named as a possibility for vice presidential ticket mate with RFK Jr. And Aaron, I do want to be respectful of the short amount of time we agreed to take with you this morning. So finally, this. What exactly have you been doing with yourself since you got that Achilles injury in that first Jets game last fall?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I've got a toe raises regimen to heal me from that injury, and rubbing oregano oil on the injury.
Oregano oil.
That's going to get me right back on the field. This is science, Andy.
Oregano oil.
It's a new way of healing a serious injury, and there's moaning therapy.
What is that?
This is very modern, Andy. It's very scientific. You wouldn't understand it. This is better than, the kind of science that, that we might have used in the past.
Better with, science.
It's a newer and better science. And I've been researching that, met with some healers.
Yep.
And, I've looked up different oils because there's other oils that you can use, and creams. There's a snail cream that you can rub onto
snail
your
cream.
No, Andy, seriously, listen to me. You can rub snail cream. It's like the ooze that snails make on your heart, and it can prevent a heart attack. So
I got
I'm working
you
on that.
Aaron, before I let you go, I should have asked you this to start with. If RFK Jr. formally asked you to run as his vice presidential candidate, what will you tell him?
Well, we're early on in those conversations, Andy. I think he's got some serious candidates. We're looking at myself. We're looking at Alex Jones. We're looking at Jesse Ventura. I think anyone from wrestling or football, or just, big guys who seem like they could be okay in a fight.
Okay.
I think that's a solid list, and
okay.
I think that's a serious list.
Okay. All right. Aaron Rodgers, thanks for getting up early on the West Coast and for joining us on the Friday Buzz.
No, I'm up at 2 a.m. That's part of my healing regimen. No sleeping.
Well, thanks for staying up and joining us on the Friday Buzz. Have a great weekend, Aaron Rodgers.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to speak with you.
Okay. Many thanks. And many thanks to Friday Buzz regular guest Scott Dickers, who played Aaron Rodgers. Scott is a founding editor of The Onion. Receive his free tips to be more creative and more inspired by subscribing to his daily Substack newsletter, No Dickering Around. All right, enough sports, enough politics. It's time for cultural news. It's St. Paddy's Day weekend, a weekend when Wisconsinites hit the bars, get drunk, stumble into the streets, retreat back into the bars, where they top off with another quarter barrel of beer per patron, then roll back into the streets with flasks filled with brandy that they brought from home and have been carrying around all day. Wait, that's every weekend in Wisconsin. I got confused there for a minute. Nothing special going on this weekend at all. Well, we don't have a St. Paddy segment per se scheduled for this morning. However, our first guest has a very Irish-American sounding name. Author and environmentalist Trish O'Kane will join us to talk about birding and activism, something she's done a great deal of in Madison. Later in the show, three members of the state champion high school mock trial team flood into the studio. It's the West High School mock trial team, state champs. And at about 8:45, the director of a new documentary will be here, Mary Mazzio's film chronicles Wisconsin's Bad River Band, ongoing fight to save Lake Superior from an aging pipeline. This is expected to rupture most any time. That's at 8:45 or so. Good morning, Engineer Without Peer Jim Wilson, DJ Ankur Malhotra. Good morning to you, my brother, and Elliot LeBrun. If you can hear me out on the front desk, good morning. Elliot is in charge of all of our post-production content, so I guess we better start making some content. It's the Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. Let's get birding. Yeah. the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Segment 1. Hurricane Katrina changed a lot of people's lives when she ravaged New Orleans in 2005. The storm transformed Tish O'Kane from a journalist into an ornithologist and environmentalist. Her home was destroyed by Katrina, and she was buoyed in a profound way by the birds that lived on after the storm. Trish moved to Madison to pursue a PhD in environmental studies. While here, she also waged war on the annual Warner Park 4th of July fireworks because of the toil the celebration took on wildlife, especially geese in the park. Her journey is beautifully mapped in a new memoir. It's called Birding to Change the World. While she was here in Madison just last week, we wanted to catch up with her this morning. Trish lives in Burlington, Vermont. That's where she joins us now by phone. Good morning, Trish, and welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Good morning. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on the Friday Buzz.
You can put that in your dossier. Take us to what was left of your New Orleans neighborhood immediately after Katrina. What did you see and hear? How did birds fill the environment and an emotional void in yourself?
Right. Well, people know from seeing the images, you know, on television and on the internet, but it's different when you're standing in the middle of it and when you have to protect yourself to go into your own home because it's a toxic site and there's mold and you're allergic to mold. So it's the smell. It was stinky. I think the first impression I had when we drove in, it was 40 days after Katrina. We weren't allowed to go back. Our neighborhood was so bad. And of course, every house had to be searched for victims. And there were many, many victims, right? But the first impression I had was we were driving into an old yellowed photograph because there was no color. It was just dusty and gray.
Are birds in general hardy survivors? What do they do in extreme weather like that? What happens to birds?
Well, it's kind of amazing, Andy, for the book. I spent a lot of time researching that and learned, you know, some birds stay put. That is one strategy, and they'll hide.
Just like humans.
Just like humans, and some evacuate, like humans, if they can. But, you know, birds, like humans, you don't want to leave your place. If you have a territory that you know, it takes a lot of energy and it's risky. But birds can detect barometric pressure drop. They have, even better than planes. I mean, the way their brains can do it. And so they can leave. And so birds, some will. They may fly hundreds or even thousands of miles to escape storms. And that's been well documented.
Totally unplanned. Just in response to the environment.
They feel the storm coming and they can hear infrasound. They can detect tsunamis. Yeah. I mean, scientists are now using birds, studying birds, to try to come up with earthquake and tsunami early detection system, so birds can help us.
Your memoir goes to the science of all this, but also to the emotions, and that's what makes it so unique, in my opinion. While you were at UW-Madison, you taught a class that was called the very same thing as you named your book, Birding to Change the World. What did students learn in that class?
Well, they learned, so many things. They were paired with a child at Sherman Middle School. So the first thing, and they spent 3 hours with them a week, walking and playing and climbing trees in Warner Park. The first thing, and I still teach this class today, now I teach it at the University of Vermont in Burlington. The first thing they learn is to listen. Because they have, some kids just talk for 3 hours and they don't talk about birds. They're talking about Fortnite, the video game, whatever it is, the student learns to listen to someone very different from them. And that's an essential life skill. They also learned about birds and they learned about the neighborhood and socioeconomics and how that affects who gets to go outside without fear or who has the gear to go outside in a cold winter place. So learning on many levels. My class is a blend of social and environmental justice with ornithology and environmental education.
You kindly agreed to read a passage from your memoir, one that describes how birds caused you to spread your own wings. Would you read that aloud to us now?
Sure, Sure, it's about a minute and a half.
Okay.
Is that all right, Andy?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
But I think it's kind of funny. Okay, so this is from Chapter 5, The Quiet Broken Ones. We create wonderful places by giving them our attention. That's a quote from David George Haskell. I have an addictive personality. It runs in the family. And when I fall in love with a person, place, or hobby, it can get a little extreme. When I was 16, I had a terrific crush on an Italian boy, a gorgeous bodybuilder, and a runner-up in the Mr. California contest. He was way out of my league. I hung out with a brainy crew viewed by the golden boys and girls of Orange County, California, as a cerebral leper colony. But this did not deter me from driving to Mr. Almost California's house late one night, filling his mailbox with spaghetti and chocolate cake, and then decorating his front lawn with borrowed, hideous, golden Egyptian sphinx statues. My ardor did not persuade him. It probably scared the hell out of the guy, but my girlfriends and I laughed about it for years. So when I picked up that very first pair of binoculars for my UW-Madison ornithology class, there should have been a red warning label on the box. Caution! Addictive and obsessive individuals should not use these to look at birds, especially while driving. The professor assigned us to go birding for an hour a week as homework, but instead of an hour a week, I was in Warner Park an hour a day, and then 2 to 3 hours a day, and then all day on weekends, and at night on owl walks. And the birds changed how I viewed and moved through every single space, even inside buildings. My eyeballs were constantly scanning the windows for feathered movement outside, and my ears were listening for bird calls beyond the walls. For the first time in my life, I was viscerally connected to the non-human creatures around me. I learned a new language, territorial calls, harsh alarm calls, parents' soft whispering calls, you big ugly human, get your hands off my nest calls, and contact calls that kept small flocks of migrating birds together, the soft clicks and checks that meant, I'm here in this backyard, or over here in the garden, or she just filled up the feeders.
Tricia Kane reading from her memoir, Birding to Change the World. She joins us in Burlington, Vermont. You mentioned Warner Park. You've mentioned it once or twice. You had a bit of a love, it became somewhat of a love-hate relationship with that part of the city of Madison. Talk about your campaign that led to mixing it up with the fireworks celebration and so forth.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say love-hate. I would say it was all love.
Okay.
I mean, that place literally saved my life. The birds in that place and the place itself. You know, and Andy, now that I've been gone 8 years, I'm looking at this in a broader perspective of the Warner Parks all over the world. Mm. And they're not just refuges for birds, but they're increasingly vital mental health refuges, respites. They're green islands of peace for the humans who live around them, especially in lower income neighborhoods like Brentwood, where I was living in Madison for 8 years. So my the campaign, I mean, it was what I learned. I was doing a dissertation. The book is based on the dissertation, a 350-page dissertation in environmental studies. And I discovered it became an environmental history and social history of Warner Park. I discovered that the place had really become the repository for all the noisy, polluting, massive events that Madison had, and I wanted to know why, right? Because it was also such a beautiful place. So, but I also discovered that neighbors for decades had been trying to stop that. So it wasn't just me. I saw that history, and then neighbors again, we banded together in Wild Warner, started with two apple pies at our kitchen table, and Wild Warner still exists. And I was just in Warner Park on Tuesday morning for 2.5 hours, crying with joy. It was so gorgeous.
Oh.
It was gorgeous.
I love that from Two Apple Pies, it persists today, just as the park does. A lot of us take birds for granted, and I expect there are lots of environmental risk in that. What are the emotional risks?
Of taking birds for granted?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a survival risk for us as a species of taking birds for granted. I mean, birds are doing jobs. They are cleaning the insects off the trees. They are literally the tree doctors of the Smithsonian Institute did a study and put cages, giant cages, on a couple of trees to keep the birds with very fine mesh, to keep the birds out of those trees, and compared them to the tree next to them that didn't have the mesh. And the trees with the mesh with no birds got very, very sick and started dying. So if we want trees, we got to keep the birds.
Tish O'Kane, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz, and have a great weekend.
Oh, you too.
Thank you. Tish O'Kane's memoir is called Birding to Change the World. Up next, we'll meet some West High School students on their way to changing the world. They're the captains of the State High School Championship Mock Trial Team. But first, some music, announcements, and then Encore Picks. You're listening to community-powered Back Porch Radio, WRT-FM 89.9, on the air, and WRT-FM.org, online, originating from South Bedford Street in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 828.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz, presenting Hanami with opening solo guitarist David Lord on Saturday, March 16th, 8 p.m. at Audio for the Arts. Hanami features Jason Stein, Andrew Trim, Charles Rumbach, and Mai Sugimoto playing electric guitar, alto sax and clarinet, bass clarinet, and drums. Hanami paints dynamic sonic landscapes on a bassless canvas, producing original arrangements of Japanese music. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Arts and Literature Laboratory, Madison's community-based contemporary arts center located at 111 South Livingston Street. Arts and Literature Laboratory houses an art gallery and performance space, a writing center and library, artist studios, and a dedicated education studio, which features classes for all ages. Information about current exhibits, performances, and classes, and how to get involved as a member or volunteer is available at artlitlab.org or on social media at artlitlab.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore, and as you well know, right about this time, every Friday morning, we set the table for you for your live music picks for the weekend. When I say we, I mean Ankur Malhotra. It's Ankur's Picks time. And now, with the Ankur's Picks disclaimer, here's Jim Wilson.
Ankur's Picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Ankur consults with an advisory board of one, Ankur Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Ankur, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Ankur has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Ankur's Picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Ankur's Picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Ankur Malhotra!
Good morning, Madison. Hope you've been enjoying the bird song outside and here on air. And lots of birds singing, if you get the drift. Tonight, High Noon Saloon, it's Mickey Sunshine, the Crib Sitters, Clean Room, and DJ Checks Cashed. 16 March, that's tomorrow. The Kissers, the two shows at High Noon Saloon, and our good old, or good young Andy Moore, with his good old banjo, rather, I should say, is going to join them on stage. We also have VO5 at the Crystal Corner, DJ Paul Gordon and DJ DH at Cardinal. And under my voice, we're hearing great Ustad Zakir Hussain, who's going to be at Shannon Hall, UW, with his project called Tisra Trio.
That's a lot. That's a lot. I hope we didn't scare everybody away from the Kissers show with that banjo notice. Thank you, Ankur. Ankur's Picks, everybody. It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Morris. Segment 2. March came in like a lion for the members of the Madison West High School mock trial team. By winning a case against Milwaukee's Shorewood High School, they became the new state champions. That was the first week of this month. By doing so, they earned the right to try a case at the U.S. National Mock Trial Competition in Wilmington, Delaware. We have a studio filled with team members right now, and we'll gavel them together here. We welcome state champion team captains Ari Blathert. I did pretty well, I think, on that. Bren Ronk and Caleb Ellenberg, welcome. Also with us is co-coach Kendall Harrison. Good morning, counselors, and welcome to the Friday Buzz. Let's start with the win itself, if we may. Ari, is there a jury that hands out a decision, or how is the winner of a mock trial determined?
So we usually have three judges, two scoring judges that sort of rank every performance, and then one presiding judge that gives their sort of overall opinion of the case.
Bryn, what did it feel like to win the case?
Pretty good. It's West's first time winning the state tournament, so I think for all of us as seniors who have been participating in the program for all 4 years, it was pretty rewarding.
How much time, Bryn, between the conclusion of the trial and the time that it took for the judges to consider, how much time passed before your win was announced?
Only a couple minutes, and that's the really nice thing, is at the state final, the judges disclose.
Caleb, what was the case that you won the state championship? What was the case about in that trial?
Yes, so the name of the case was Flynn Forrester versus Sam Sargent, and it was a case of mysterious mushrooms. Flynn Forrester and Sam Sargent were friends, and Sam Sargent brought these mushrooms back from Washington, and it's a little bit, the facts are a little bit disputed on this point. That's what we were arguing about in trial. But basically, either Sam offered Flynn these mushrooms and told them they were hallucinogenic, or Sam just showed Flynn the mushrooms and Flynn grabbed them, and it's this disputed case. But what ended up happening, unfortunately, is Flynn, who is fictional, ended up almost dying because the mushrooms were poisonous.
Oh my, and the West team was the plaintiff, is that correct?
We have two teams on both sides. Okay. So I was on our defense side, and Ari and Bryn are on the plaintiff's side.
Oh, my. So this divided even between one single entry team, is that correct?
Yes.
Did you guys win cases at the competition on your way to the trial against Shorewood?
Yes.
How much time does a team have during the competition to prepare? When are the terms, for want of a better word, of a case presented to you, Ari?
The case usually drops around the beginning of October, and then we have from October until February when our regional competition is, and then the teams that do well at regionals advance to the state competition in March. And then we have the whole state competition.
That's cool, because it seems like that in the real world, that would be perhaps approximately as much time as a law firm might have. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with members and a co-coach of the West High School state champion mock trial team. I'm going to talk with the team's coach now for a minute, but before I do, fair warning, team members, in a minute I'm going to come back to each of you and I'm going to ask you what you believe is the most valuable skill a trial attorney must have. So think about that. And meanwhile, Coach Kendall Harrison, what does a practice look like for a mock trial team? What are the drills?
We spend a lot of time scrimmaging amongst ourselves and actually doing practice trials. We also spend a fair bit of time thinking about and learning the rules of evidence and really the art of storytelling, because at the end of the day, the team that ends up doing the best is usually the one that tells the best story.
Well, you know, I think that was proven even by Caleb's colorful description of that mushroom case. And so I really like that element of it. And that, after all, is an art of persuasion, right?
It absolutely is. And that's one of the things that I think is so great about mock trial. It gives kids an opportunity to be part of a team, to learn many valuable skills going forward in life. But one of the things we talk about a lot is you're learning to persuade. And there are many ways to do that. You can do that with the mind. You can do that with the heart. And you got to figure out how to bring all these things together in a single unit to be as persuasive as you possibly can.
Okay, we're going to now come back to the students, and they've had a moment to think about this important question. Ari, the most valuable asset, in your opinion, a trial attorney must have?
I think the ability to think on one's feet. So, you know, throughout the trial, we are making objections, responding to objections to try and keep evidence in or out. And it's oftentimes things that we've never heard before. Most of the trial is pretty rehearsed and standard, but then the objections are where you really have to think on your feet, and that's a lot of times where the difference is.
Okay, Bryn, the most valuable asset a trial attorney must have.
I'm going to echo what Kendall said about storytelling. We're given 40 minutes to present a case in mock trial, so I think the ability to kind of like crystallize all the facts that you're presented with in the case materials and use those effectively to persuade the jury.
There's so many applications to that ability, aren't there, Coach, with regards to being concise, being clear, making your point, and getting out.
And also just learning to build confidence, because there's nothing that will give you a boost like standing in front of a room of people and having to adapt to the moment and then afterwards thinking, yeah, I can do that.
Oh, it's really quite inspiring. It's a great opportunity. We've got Caleb now. You've had an extra 30 seconds, and I know that time matters. The most valuable asset a trial attorney must have, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, absolutely echoing what Ari and Bryn said, and I also think teamwork. You know, our state team is 12 people, but there have been more than 50 people involved in our mock trial organization this year. And both in the trial itself, when you have your co-counsel and talking to them, well, more often we pass sticky notes. It's kind of exciting. We're like hurriedly passing notes, writing things during the trial. But then throughout the year, this team, like, we all practice together, all 50 of us, and we work together. We build off each other's ideas. And this mock trial it's really a team sport, or a sport if you want to call it that.
Yes.
But we all work together, and I think that's really important.
Caleb, do you know what the case is you must, that you'll have to try in Delaware at the Nationals?
Actually, no. That's part of the excitement, or the fun of it, and maybe the pressure of it too. But for Nationals, they really want to test your ability to prep on a short time period, so they're going to announce the case at the end of March, so we'll have about a month to prepare our case.
That's quite a bit a different time spread than that October drop, but not exactly the day before either, but that's going to be a lot of work. How many hours now, this is getting personal, but how many hours
like a sports commitment. Are you giving this, and will you, between now and the May national championships, Bryn, how many hours a week do you think?
I think, well, this is our first time going to nationals, so I don't exactly know if we all know what the time commitment is going to be like. I think we're anticipating that we're going to, you know, have to take things up a notch, obviously. But between now and when the case is dropping, we're also going to be going over, there are new rules of evidence, new competition rules. So the work doesn't start on March 29th. It's starting now, really.
Do you guys know all the lawyer jokes?
Would you like to tell one?
Well, I do have one, but I was wondering if you had any. I play the banjo. There's a lot of banjo jokes, and it seems like there's a lot of lawyer jokes, too. Are you going to make me tell it?
Yeah, tell it.
All right. A man walked into a lawyer's office and inquired about the lawyer's rates. $250 for three questions, replied the lawyer. Isn't that awfully steep? Asked the man. Yes, the lawyer replied. And what was your third question? I don't know. This is kind of getting personal, and I don't want to assume anything about what we can draw from your commitment to this activity and where you see yourself in 10 years. But where do you see yourself in 10 years, Ari?
Well, I am hoping to pursue music in some form throughout my life, and then I'm also hoping to be some form of scientific researcher as well.
Bryn?
I have absolutely no idea, and I'm so sorry that I can't give you a better answer.
I don't be sorry. I think that's the best answer of all. You're making the best of things right now, and that's for sure. And Caleb?
I mean, I guess I'm going to be the only one who maybe echoes what you might expect us to say. I'm thinking about maybe being a lawyer. But again, like Bryn, who knows where I'll end up. But it's funny because the judges at the end of almost every trial are always asking us. They're like, okay, y'all were really good. Who wants to be a lawyer? And in my freshman year, there was a trial where I didn't raise my hand. No one else raised their hand. And the judge was like, why? Why is no one raising their hand? So over the course of my time in this club, they've convinced me to think about being a lawyer. I think that'd be a cool job.
Caleb Ellenberg, Bryn Ronk, Ari Blehart, and Coach Kendall Harrison, all from the new state champion mock trial team from Madison West High School, the Regents. Thank you for coming into the studio this morning, and please leave your business cards at the front desk. Thank you. All right, we're going to take a music break, and when we return, we'll hear about the new documentary, Bad River, from the film's director. That's after this musical break. This is WRT FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:44.
I wonder why that is. Paper boy don't come no more.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Segment 3. Our next guest is the director of an important look and an important and ongoing work the Bad River people in northern Wisconsin have been doing on the part of everyone who cares about the planet and specifically about Lake Superior. The film is called Bad River. It opens today in selected cities across the country, including Milwaukee and in Madison. Here's the trailer for the film. Let's listen to that, Jim Wilson.
This is a story of the Bad River people and their home on Lake Superior.
Our people have been here for millennia.
They've had to fight for who they are.
And the Ojibwe have been resisting ever since.
There was a black car that used to ride around. We see that coming, we run.
They basically just grab kids and take them off to these boarding schools.
They were modeled after prison systems.
It was a genocidal project.
The whole idea was your culture is primitive.
The oppression, the racism just hit a pinnacle.
It was all built up.
You punk.
I thought Native people were going to get killed.
There's always some kind of threat.
They've had to fight to protect their land.
Seems improbable that a pipe would be hanging in midair.
That's a ticking time bomb.
When the meander reaches the pipeline,
apocalyptic.
It breaks, you know, this is gonna pour right into Lake Superior. And that's bad.
It is the grandmother of the Great Lakes. It is the freshwater stronghold of planet Earth.
Trying to shut down a pipeline, that's a major endeavor.
It's a David and Goliath type of situation, right?
You gotta stop it.
My little tribe is protecting water for the planet.
It'll be one hell of a fight.
This is a story of defiance.
We gotta protect our water. To die for it. We have to.
That's the trailer from Bad River, a film that premieres tonight at the AMC Theaters in Fitchburg. The director of Bad River, Mary Mazzio, joins us now by phone. I believe you're in Boston. Mary, good morning. Welcome to the Friday Buzz.
Hey, good morning, Andy. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for sharing Bad River with your audience.
Yes, it's so exciting to be able to talk with you, even as we anticipate it, opening this evening. The environmental threat of a rusting pipeline in northern Wisconsin is the pulse point of the story. Tell us about that pipeline.
So, first and foremost, the Bad River Band, as you know, is situated in northern Wisconsin on Lake Superior. They have been battling land takings for centuries, but the current chapter of what we call a very old story is that of a 70-year-old pipeline that transverses the reservation about 12 miles of which. The pipeline's ability to operate expired on 3 miles of the pipeline corridor 10 years ago. That coupled with a bend in the Bad River, she's changing her course and she's headed right to the pipeline. And as the lower court found in the case that the Bad River Band filed against this Canadian pipeline operator, is today at risk of rupture and could happen as soon as the next big flood.
Which could be any time. What is in the pipeline?
The pipeline is consistent primarily of crude oil.
Yeah.
There is a little bit of liquid natural gas, propane that's offloaded in the Upper Peninsula. But basically, this is a thoroughfare to move crude oil from Western Canada to Eastern Canada. And when the pipeline was installed in the 50s, by the way, it had no consent from the Bad River Band, but this was a time when pipelines, mines, and dams sort of began being installed all across America, many of which were on Native lands, and that's a whole other complicated story.
There were images in the trailer, images that the radio audience couldn't see, there are images of those, at least for us old-timers in the Wisconsin political press, remember all too well. Scenes that represent Bad River's and other Wisconsin Ojibwe bands' fight to maintain sovereignty, scenes like the late 1980s treaty rights dispute over off-reservation walleye spearing. How much does the film get into the contemporary struggles beyond the pipeline fight of Bad River?
Great question, Andy. And in truth, I thought this was going to be a David and Goliath, you know, little Bad River fighting this huge Canadian conglomerate. But we started doing interviews with tribal elders, and that changed the whole complexion of the story. Because to your point, they, of course, they were happy to talk about the current challenge, but they also wanted to talk about the open pit mine, right, that mm-hmm. they sort of pushed back against when that was going to be constructed in the Pinokies at the Bad River headwaters. And then they wanted to go back in time to share stories of themselves, their parents, their grandparents, with respect to their treaty-guaranteed rights to hunt, fish, and gather that you talked about, which were the Walleye Wars, a very, very painful chapter. Before that, it was the boarding schools. Before that, it was Chief Buffalo, you know, taking trains, planes, and automobiles, fighting back early removal orders. And so this became a historical retrospective, Andy, in ways that, frankly, I could not have even imagined from the get-go.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with documentary filmmaker Mary Mazzio. Her film Bad River premieres in selected cities across the country tonight, including at Madison's AMC Theaters in Fitchburg. Mary, I understand you screened the film midweek this week with a congressional audience. What was that about, and how did it go?
It was, boy, what an event. I'll tell you, Chairman Blanchard was in the House, and he had a remarkable quote. So he introduced the film along with Representative Charisse Davids, and he said, you know, President Biden earlier this week spoke to fighting for the soul of the nation. He said, here in Bad River, we are fighting for the spirits of our home. I mean, it was an extraordinary mic drop, but that introduction symbolizes this monumental effort that the Bad River Band is waging to protect, and you know, being from Madison, right, Lake Superior, one of the world's most precious resources, not for themselves, but for all of us. And Andy, you probably also know that the Bad River Band is doing this at considerable cost. This is a painful battle. And they're doing it, as Mike Wiggins said, you know, this is the freshwater stronghold of America. Our band, our community is fighting this fight because we are patriots. This is part of our civic responsibility to the country. What?
Yeah.
What an amazing perspective.
How long is the film?
The film is about 85 minutes.
God, so much in there in 85, I'm sure. The production seems to promise energy is delivered by two narrative participants, too. Indigenous activist Quanah Chasing Horace and actor Edward Norton. What is there to know about their contributions?
Oh, yeah, well, Edward Norton just took to Twitter yesterday with just a boy. He came out guns a-blazing with respect to his perspective and his feelings about the fight that the Bad River Band is fighting. Quanah is amazing. Of course, she is. Here's what she said. She said something to me like, you know, watching this film, I'm so proud. I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud to be involved as a Native person. This will open people's eyes, but heal people's hearts.
Oh.
And I thought that was just a beautiful sentiment for, at the end of the day, this is a story of resilience, of power, of standing up for what's right. And as Running Horse Livingston, a Bad River band member, said just like 2 weeks ago, he said, you know, win, lose, or draw, it's in our DNA to fight the good fight. We are doing this to protect the watershed, to protect Lake Superior, because we don't want to be having a conversation after a rupture.
These are stubborn, living, emotional controversies, ongoing controversies. Mary, what was the biggest challenge telling the story of the Bad River Band?
Oh, there were many. And I will say, you know, being a non-Native person and coming onto the reservation, I'm sure they were like, what the hell is she doing here? And I have to say that over the course, this took about 2 years, and the relationships that you inevitably build are so precious. And, you know, 86-year-old Myron Burns, you know, he, are we profanity-free here, by the way, Andy? I'm assuming yes.
What?
Are we profanity-free?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, he calls me to shoot the whatever.
Right? Yes.
Burns, he calls me every 2 weeks to talk about his beloved Packers. he sent me Bad River Wild Rice at Christmas. And you know, he's 86 years old. Mm. And I said to former Chairman Mike Wiggins, I said, you know, this is so precious. Like, I love that he calls me every 2 weeks. And I said, I don't know why he likes me so much. And Mike said, look, he's an old spirit, right? Mm. And he said, he thinks you dropped out of the sky. And he's not quite sure why, but we think it might be good.
Oh, my God.
These, honestly, building these relationships have been, honestly, a career highlight. I feel so indebted to the Bad River community, really, because when you see the film, and of course it's playing in Madison, I think even AMC has expanded the screenings tonight to 11 times today, or 8 times, or and tomorrow as well. And the Bad River Tribal Council is fanning out to 6 of the 12 cities that we're opening with welcoming remarks, and that's going to happen tonight in Madison. Robert Houle, the band's secretary, will be there to welcome moviegoers. And of course, Madison is exactly where the first element of the fight happened with the lower court, federal district court Judge Conley, who ruled several months ago, in a kind of a stunning ruling. He said, look, this pipeline is in a state of trespass. It could burst as soon as the next big flood. And Enbridge, you need to shut this down. But I'm going to give you a 3-year period because I'm concerned about the economic impact, primarily in Canada, where most of the Line 5 product is, is transported. Enbridge, of course, appealed immediately, and it's now been kicked up to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago.
Mary Mazzia, thank you for taking the time with us this morning. It was especially cool to hear some of those new details about who will be present at the screening tonight in Fitchburg. Mary Mazzia, congratulations on the film, and good luck with the opening across the country.
Andy, thank you so much, and very much appreciate it. And for your listeners, if they want any more information, badriverfilm.com.
All right, Mary. Okay, take care out there.
All right. Take care, Andy. Thanks so much again.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Mary Mazzia is the director of the documentary film Bad River. It opens tonight, as we've been speaking about, at the AMC Theaters in Fitchburg. We got just enough time to wrap the program up, maybe with a little bit of music underneath. Me would be fantastic. Jim Wilson, thank you. Engineer Without Peer, Ankur Malhotra. DJ Spin Cycle, thank you. Elliot LeBrun, piloting the front desk this morning. Also, the West High School mock trial team captains here this morning, and we appreciate them so much. Stay tuned for the Insurgent Radio Kiosk and then Chris Powers and Mud Acres. This is WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Andy Moore. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha. Kama'aina.
Stats, my breath smelling like similac. Can tell by the friendly chat. Kiosk for Friday, March 15th.
This being a reading of the last statement of James Connolly, I quote: "To the Field General Court Martial held at Dublin Castle, May 9th, 1916. We went out to break the connection between this country and the British Empire and to establish an Irish Republic. We believe the call we then issued to the people of Ireland was a nobler call and a holier cause than any call issued to them during that World War or having any connection with the war. We succeeded in proving that Irish men are ready to die, endeavouring to win for Ireland those national rights which the British government has been asking them to die to win for Belgium. As long as that remains the case, the cause of Irish freedom is safe. Believing that the British government has no right in Ireland. even a respectable minority willing to die to affirm that truth. Makes that government forever a usurpation and a crime against human progress. I personally thank God that I have lived to see the day when